Hey, what is up, Pine Lake family? Man, so great to see you all. Welcome all of our campuses and those of you that might be joining us online as well. Man, I hope you're having a great summer. Our crew just got back off of our annual beach trip where we had 33 of us in the same house for a week. We had 18 kids and 15 adults. Ages were from 88 to 1. And it was a wild, wild week. It was a blast. And I need a vacation. And I've been teaching every weekend as well, so I'm super excited to be back here in the SIP, and Pine Lake feels so much like home for me. I love y'all and just grateful to be a small part of being one of the voices in this place. Anybody do any binge watching this summer on a break? Like you've been hearing about some Netflix series or some Amazon Prime series, you just sat down, you like binge watched the whole thing. Anybody do that this summer? The very first series I can ever remember doing that with was a series called 24 with Jack Bauer. Anybody remember this series? Debbie and I would watch these things. It'd be like, we watched six in a row. And then 2 o'clock in the morning, we turn to each other and go, "You got one more?" "Yeah, I got one more. We just couldn't stop watching the thing. So what I'd like to do today, I would like to binge watch an entire series. And you can find the whole riveting story in the Old Testament section of the Bible. But man, this thing has got it all. I'm talking wild parties, lust, greed, murder, conspiracy, social networking, defiance, challenge, risk, twists and turns. I mean, there is nothing boring about the story of this woman named Esther. And we're going to just try to watch all 8 episodes. We're going to binge watch the entire series in about 30 minutes. Y'all up for that? All right, so here we go. We're going to call episode 1, The Hangover. The beginning of the story tells us that King Xerxes is the ruler of the Persian Empire, the most powerful empire in the world at that time, which would make him, you guessed it, the most powerful man in the world, and he knows it. And being the most powerful man in the world, he knew how to do a lot of things, including throw big parties. So episode 1 begins with King Xerxes throwing a party for all of his officials, the nobles of all the provinces, military leaders, princes, everybody who was anybody is there. This is the bash of all bashes, and it just isn't a one-night bender either. Look what it says. For a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. You think you've pulled some all-nighters? This party that Xerxes throws in honor of himself lasts for half a year. And if 180 days wasn't enough, when it's all over, the king throws another 7-day banquet for everybody in the city of Susa. And by the king's edict, there are absolutely no limits placed on drinking. Now, usually invited guests could only drink when the king would give a toast, but not this week. It is open bar. It's like the Grove on steroids. Everybody is wasting away in Margaritaville. On the last day of the event, it says this, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, which might be the case after a 186-day kegger, he sends some of his men to go get the queen, Queen Vashti, and bring her out wearing the royal crown and only the royal crown, because he wanted the nobles and all the other men to gaze on her beauty, for she was a very beautiful woman. How sick is that? Any of you wives be down for that? Well, Queen Vashti isn't either. So when they go to get her, she refuses to come. It says, this made the king furious, and he burned with anger. So the king goes to his advisors to figure out what he should do with Queen Vashti for disobeying his commands, and they suggest that they have her banished. And they said, also, here's an idea. Let the king give her royal position to someone else who is better than she. And you know what they meant by better. And so they proposed that a search should be made for all the young, beautiful virgins in every province of Xerxes' realm, bring in the best, give them beauty treatments, and then let the girl who pleases the king, let her be the new queen. Verse 4, this advice appealed to the king, you think? And he followed it, which brings us to episode 2. We'll call it Project Runway. So we got all these beautiful young women being rounded up and brought to the citadel of Susa. I can only imagine how many girls there were. And check this out, verse 12, before a girl's turn came to go in to see King Xerxes, she had to complete 12 months of beauty treatments prescribed for the women, 6 months with oil of myrrh, 6 with perfumes and cosmetics. 12 months of prep time is a long time. And this wasn't like getting to go to like a extended, you know, spa retreat. There was a lot of pressure on these girls. I mean, lots of pretty girls in one place, all trying to get the same rose, crown. Think about the jealousy, the competition, the backstabbing, the comparison going on. I mean, this was made for reality TV. And this guy is not a bachelor. Well, among this group of young women is a girl named Esther. She's this Jewish orphan who had been raised by her cousin, Mordecai. And Mordecai is this Jewish man who was taken captive from Jerusalem during the Babylonian rule of King Nebuchadnezzar. He is one of the many displaced Jewish people in the region. They're no longer in captivity, but they're not really at home anywhere either. They're just scattered all throughout the region. Verse 7 says, when her father and mother died, Mordecai adopted her into his own family and raised her as his own daughter. So Mordecai loves this girl. And verse 11 says that after Esther had been taken to the palace to be part of this show, every day Mordecai would take a walk near the courtyard of the harem to find out about Esther and what was happening to her. So Mordecai is a really, really good dude. He cares deeply about Esther, and he feels like it's his duty to protect her. That's why he instructs Esther to keep her family background, her Jewish heritage, a secret. So she does. And guess what happens? Of all the young women brought to Susa, it says this, Esther, just as she was, won the admiration of everyone who saw her. I love that phrase, just as she was. Maybe she wins because she wasn't trying so hard. She just radiated from the inside out. And maybe, I don't know, maybe that's a good word for every single one of us. Esther, just as she was, won the admiration of everyone who saw her, including King Xerxes. It's been 4 years since the night he banished Queen Vashti, and I'm sure there were hundreds, probably thousands of beautiful young girls he could have chosen in those 4 years, but it's finally Esther who wins his favor. Verse 17, so he sets a royal crown on her head and makes her queen instead of Vashti. At the end of the day, Esther, the Jewish orphan raised by her displaced cousin, perhaps the most unlikely of all the girls, was the one who is handed the crown. Now, unlike Cinderella, the story doesn't end here with Esther with a, and they lived happily ever after. No, the plot thickens for this humble orphan girl turned queen. We'll call episode 3, Criminal Minds. There are a few criminal minds in this story, Bigthana, Teresh, and Haman. And interestingly, Mordecai ends up being the lead undercover investigator in every case. See, Mordecai has this job working at the king's gate. And one day he overhears two of the king's guards, Bigthana and Teresh, plotting to assassinate the king. Well, Mordecai goes and tells Esther about the plot. She reports it to the king, giving all the credit to Mordecai. And when the report was investigated and found out to be true, these two thugs lose their lives. And the end of verse 23 adds this, this was all recorded in the book of the history of King Xerxes' reign. I mean, this kind of goes into Mordecai's personnel file in the HR department. On such and such a date, Mordecai saved the king's life. Hang on to that for a minute. Then there's the criminal mind of a guy named Haman. And just like all great villains in movies or novels, Haman is kind of on the inside. He was the king's right-hand guy, the highest ranking official in the empire. And this guy has an ego to match his position. His position was so high that when he passed by other officials, they would all bow down to him. Except for this one guy. There was this Jewish man who worked the front gate that believed in only bowing to God. You guessed it, Mordecai. So day after day, Haman passes by the king's gate and everybody bows. Mordecai perhaps gives a smile and a nod, but he doesn't bow. And that infuriates Haman. In fact, he is so filled with rage, he decides to do something about it. And you talk about an overreaction? Look at this, verse 6 of chapter 3. He had learned of Mordecai's nationality. So he decided it was not enough to lay hands on Mordecai alone. Instead, he looked for a way to destroy all the Jews throughout the entire empire of Xerxes. You talk about an evil ego out of control. So in the month of April, they cast lots, they roll the dice to see when would be a good day on the calendar to annihilate all the Jews. And they land on March 7th, almost a year later. Looked like a good day for an ethnic cleansing. You know, schedule was free. So Haman goes and coerces the king to sign off on his plan, explaining to him there's this like certain race of people. They're scattered throughout the provinces. They're just different than everybody else. They keep separate. They have different laws. They worship a different God. And in fact, and this wasn't true, they refuse to obey the king's laws. He convinces the king that there's this rogue group of people that should be destroyed and their money and belongings taken. And so the king, on his advice, agrees, tells Haman, well, the money and the people are both yours to do with as you see fit. And so later that week, on April 17th, a decree is written, translated into the language of each province, and the messengers deliver it, the order that all Jews, young and old, including women and children, must be killed, slaughtered, or annihilated on a single day. And this was scheduled to happen on March 7th of the next year. I mean, can you imagine this? I mean, this is horrific. This unspeakable plan from the criminal mind of a very evil dude. I mean, think about what it must have been like for the Jewish people to hear those messengers say on March 7th of next year, every Jew, young and old, is going to be killed. Can you imagine what it would be like to have that date like circled on a calendar? 11 months to anticipate your death and the death of those closest to you. 11 months to try to pack up and run. But where do you run to? They had no real home. So as the news begins to spread, the entire Jewish community begins to weep and wail. They cover themselves in burlap and ashes, which was a traditional way of expressing brokenness and mourning, desperately asking God to intercede on their behalf. Chapter 4, verse 1, when Mordecai learned about all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on burlap and ashes, and went out into the city crying with a loud and bitter wail. Well, this news about Mordecai weeping and wailing and lying in sackcloth travels to Esther. And so she sends a messenger, Hatach, to find out what in the world is wrong with her dear cousin, her adoptive father. And Mordecai relays the entire story back to Esther. And then he says he also asked Hatach to direct her, go to the king and beg for mercy and plead for your people. And Esther sends back a reply that goes something like this. You got to be kidding. I can't do that. Everybody knows that to go to the king uninvited is against the law. The punishment is death. I mean, the only exception is if the king holds out his gold scepter as an invitation. And I don't see that happening. We've been married for almost 5 years, and the king hasn't asked for me in 30 days, if you know what I'm saying. Not a real good time for me to reveal my secret heritage or to ask the king for any favors. This is way too risky. This is way too much of an ask of me. Now, Esther had to believe that her response would be sufficient because Mordecai loved her and he would understand. He was her protector, after all. There was no way he would actually expect her to take a huge risk like this. But Mordecai sends this famous reply back to Esther. Don't think for a moment that because you're in the palace, you will escape when all other Jews are killed. If you keep quiet at a time like this, deliverance and relief for the Jews will arise from some other place. But you and your relatives will die. Who knows if perhaps you were made queen for such a time as this? Not exactly what Esther was expecting to hear. Mordecai is reminding her that although she is a queen, living in a plush, sheltered life inside the palace with maids and servants and a closet full of designer clothes, she's still Jewish. And this decree applies to her as well. And even if she does escape it, those closest to her will not. So he asks her to find some courage, to not back down, not to take the easy way out. He challenges her by saying, who knows? Who knows? Maybe you were in that palace. Maybe, just maybe, you were made queen for such a time as this. See, the opposite of courage is not fear. It's self-preservation. It's wanting to protect ourselves, shield ourselves, just remain safe and comfortable. Have you been there? Man, I have. I like what Karen Job says. Esther had to overcome herself in order to do what God had created her and positioned her to do. You ever had to overcome yourself? I almost have to do it every day of my life. And I'm learning as well that you and I can refuse to obey God or cower in fear from the calling he's got on our life. And you know what? He's still going to accomplish his agenda. Just like Mordecai said, if you don't do this, it will arise from another place. I mean, God will accomplish his plan because Mordecai remembered that God had made a promise centuries before to Abraham that God would bless the entire world through the Jewish nation. A savior for the entire world would come through their lineage. So he knew that somehow, some way, God would accomplish his long-term plans. He always does. But what happens is that you and I pass up the fulfillment of our own life purpose, and we, and maybe even those closest to us, miss out on the incredible work that God wants to do in and through our lives. Irvin McManus puts it this way. He says, if you wait for guarantees, the only thing that will be guaranteed is that you will miss endless divine opportunities. We all want miracles, and then we spend our lives avoiding the context for which miracles happen. Gang, we all need to take some courage. I mean, if you're a new parent, maybe you got a little kid, maybe a junior high or high school student, man, those can be scary years being a parent of kids. I've been there. There are a lot of guarantees, definitely a whole lot of uncertainty, but I'm just telling you, don't back down from that high calling. Don't be apathetic. Don't take the easy way out. Be courageous because God has placed you in that boy's life, in that girl's life, for such a time as this. If you're a boss, if you're a business leader, and things are a little bit scary right now, a little tight, a little uncertain, and there's definitely some opportunity to keep things going up and to the right if you're willing to bend a few rules, if you're willing to be just a little dishonest, come on, don't settle for that stuff. Grab some courage. Be brave. Perhaps you're the leader that's full of integrity for such a time as this. If you're a college student, if you're a high school student, if you're a junior high student, and you know that God is just asking you to lovingly stand courageously for him as you head back to school. And there might be some ridicule. There might be some exclusion. Things might even get hard for you. But don't shrink back. Be kind. Be humble. Love well. But be brave. Perhaps you are in that school. Perhaps you are on that campus for such a time as this. Maybe you've sensed God ask you to do something that seems way too big of an ask. And the timing's not real great. It would make things really uncomfortable. There's way too many obstacles, too many hurdles, may create a little chaos in your routine. Listen, don't think for a second that God only asks other people to take risks. That he wouldn't ask something risky of you, because he would. He does. And who knows, you just might be the man or the woman who was born for such a time as this. You see, Esther had a choice. Courage is always a choice. So let's just call episode 4, Braveheart. After hearing Mordecai's "for such a time as this" speech, there's an internal shift in Esther. So she sends back a message telling Mordecai to have the Jewish people fast and pray for her for 3 days. By the way, never underestimate asking other people to pray for you when you need some courage. And she tells him this, "When this is done, the 3 days are over, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." I mean, this is so cool to me. She goes from, this is way too big of an ask. This is way too risky. This is way too much to ask of me. This really isn't a good time. I could die for even approaching the king. To, you know what, Mordecai, you're right. You're right. Perhaps this is the reason I'm here. If not me, then who? If not now, then when? I have to do this. I'm the only one who can go to the king. And if I perish, well, I perish. I just think it's so cool how she moves from the mindset of self-preservation to bold courage. I mean, she could have shrunk back. She could have stayed comfortable in her royal room. She could have played it safe and just let it all play out. But she doesn't. And listen, you may be feeling all kinds of regret for opportunities you think you might have missed along the way, all the times you chose comfort over courage and character. I got a few regrets like that myself, but I'm telling you, no matter how big of a coward you may have been in the past, no matter how far away you ran from the opportunity, no matter how much your life you've lived in self-preservation mode, no matter how inadequate or underqualified you may have felt, you too could be just one courageous decision away from breaking that same old storyline and plunging your life into this adventure of faith, freedom, hope, and purpose. I can tell you from my own experience, my life and character have grown in direct proportion to my courage. The times that I have taken a deep breath and swallowed really hard and walked to the edge of all the knowledge I had and then stepped out in faith just following the lead of Jesus, man, I look back and I think what adventures I would have missed out on if I decided just to play it safe and maintain my comfort. My wife Debbie did a Bible study several years ago where there was a little fill-in-the-blank exercise that helped her with all this. You see, Esther had to fill in the blanks too. She said those powerful words in verse 16, if I perish, then I perish. And using that sentence, I want us to think about our own fill in the blanks. If blank, then blank. In that first blank, think about a fear that you have. It could be your worst fear, it could be a current fear, it could be a reoccurring fear. But think about a fear you've got for that first blank. If the biopsy comes back positive, if the bank forecloses on our home, if I'm pregnant again, if she files for divorce, if I get cut from the team, just put your greatest fear in that first blank. And let me tell you what our enemy wants to do to us. He wants us to think about that fear, focus on that fear, that first blank. He wants us to mess with us. He wants us to start to believe that if blank ever happened, then we'd just be done. There is no way we would ever recover from it, no way we could ever get up from that blank happening. That's why it is so crucial to fill in the second blank before you ever fill in the first blank. Because no matter what goes in the first blank, this is what we have to put in that second blank ahead of time. If blank, then God. If my worst fear happens, well, then God. He will be enough for me. He will pick me back up. He will be my strength. He will be all that he says he is. He will do all that he promises he will do because my God is bigger than my blank. And I trust him. And that is Esther's resolve. Episode 5, Shark Tank. Ever seen those entrepreneurs on that show? They walk out in front of all the sharks sitting there, all those billionaires, and they make their goofy sales pitch. I mean, they're so nervous. I can't imagine what's going through Esther's mind. Now, Mordecai told Esther what she needed to do, but not how to do it. In fact, he even coached her. When you go in there, make sure when you make your pitch before the king, make sure you plead and you beg. But she doesn't do that. She doesn't come to the king as a beggar. She doesn't come with a cheesy, memorized sales pitch. She doesn't choose to wear some kind of sexy lingerie as a member of his harem or even as his wife. Instead, she gets dressed in her royal robes and she confidently walks down the hall as the queen of the Persian Empire. That is just so cool to me. Can you imagine her walking down that hallway, knowing that with each step, she's getting closer to closer to the king seeing her, which remember, to come to the king uninvited is a capital offense. And I bet she knew if she even stopped for a moment, she might run back to her room. So she doesn't stop. Just step after fearful step, she keeps walking. See, courage is not the absence of fear. It's moving ahead in spite of the fear. And as she comes into view, the guards, the Secret Service guys, they're ready to pounce, ready to take her out before she can reach the king. But the king takes a look at her dressed in her royal robes. He sees her clothed in confidence. He stops the guards and holds out the gold scepter to her and asks, "What is it, Queen Esther? What do you want? Just ask, and it's yours." She says, "Well, if it pleases the king, let the king, together with Haman, come today to a banquet I've prepared for him." And the king says, "Okay, you know me. I love a good party. You got it." And so the king calls for Haman, the villain in the story, the hater of Mordecai, the soon-to-be annihilator of the Jews. And together, the two of them go to this banquet that Esther has prepared. And there the king asks her again, "Tell me, Queen Esther, what is it that you want? Just ask, and it's yours." And she says, "Let's talk about it later. Why don't the two of you come back again tomorrow for another banquet?" And the king agrees. Now, there's lots of thoughts and theories on why Esther didn't make her request at the first banquet. Some think she just plain chickened out, couldn't do it. Some thought thinks that she was over anxious, didn't feel like it was the right timing. Some even think she was trying to make the king suspicious as to why she kept inviting Haman, trying to make him jealous. But I think she was just plain brilliant to keep the king hanging on the edge of intrigue and at the same time blowing up Haman's ego. Well, the king leaves the banquet very intrigued. Esther leaves the banquet full of courage. And Haman, oh my goodness, he leaves the banquet feeling pretty darn full of himself. He is so excited about having dinner with the royal family and then being invited back a second time. It says he left the banquet happy and in high spirits, so full of himself. But it all changes when he has to walk past the king's gate and see once again, oh, that Mordecai guy still refusing to bow to his greatness. Well, Haman goes home, and if his day hadn't been eventful enough, he throws another party at his house to brag to his wife and friends about his wining and dining with the king and the queen. He tells them, you know what? I'm a pretty big deal. I'm the only one the queen invited. This has been one unforgettable day. And you know what? I was feeling so good about myself. And then on my way home, that stupid Jew, Mordecai, ruined my day. I cannot stand that guy. So his wife, Zeresh, and his friends say to him, you know what you ought to do? Have a gallows built 75 feet high and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai hanged on it. And then just go be with the king and the queen and go to dinner and be happy. This suggestion delighted Haman. And so he had the gallows built. Episode 6, insomnia or sleepless in Susa. Chapter 6, verse 1, that night the king had trouble sleeping, so he ordered an attendant to bring the book of the history of his reign so it could be read to him. This is just funny to me. I can't sleep. Can we read that book about me? Anyway, just ask the king, right? And guess when they read the book about him, what story is read? I mean, they flip the page and read the story about the time Mordecai saved the king's life from those two guards that were plotting to assassinate him. And the king asked the attendants that were reading to him, what reward or recognition did we ever give Mordecai for this? And they say, well, actually, nothing. I don't think we ever really did anything for him. At that time, the king hears someone in the outer courtyard, and he says, who's in the court? And it says, now Haman had just entered the outer court of the palace to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows he had erected for him. This is good stuff. And so the king asked Haman, hey, I was just wondering about something. I'm glad you stopped by. What should I do for someone that I want to honor? Now, of course, Haman, with his ego, thinks to himself, oh, who would the king want to honor besides me? So he says, well, I think you ought to bring in the royal robe, the king's horse, put a royal crest on his head, and let the most noble princes lead him through the streets shouting, this is what is done for the man the king delights to honor. The king says to Haman, excellent, quick, take the robes and my horse and do just as you have said, for Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the gate of the palace, leave out nothing you have suggested. This is so awesome. And Haman has to do it. I wish I could have been there. Episode 6 ends with this, verse 12. After Mordecai returned to the palace gate, but Haman hurried home dejected and completely humiliated. Episode 7. Flip or flop. The plan is beginning to flip and Haman's beginning to feel the flop. He is humiliated, dejected, reeling a little bit about how his plan is coming unraveled. So he shows up at this second banquet that Esther has prepared for just him and the king. And as they're sitting there, the king, now at the peak of his curiosity, asks again, come on, I need to know. What is it that you want, Queen Esther? Just ask, and it is yours. And Esther takes a deep breath and says with humility and courage, great king, if I have ever found favor with you, grant me this. I'm asking you to spare my life, spare my people, for we have been sold for destruction, slaughter, and annihilation. And the king says, what? By whom? Like, who would do that? I mean, where is the man who would dare do such a thing? And Esther says, sitting right there, this wicked Haman is our adversary and our enemy. Haman grew pale with fright before the king and queen. Well, the king goes off. This was his right-hand guy. This was his highest-ranking official. How could somebody on the inside do something like this? So Xerxes steps out in the garden to kind of cool off. And while he's gone, Haman begins to beg Esther for his life. And it says this, in despair, he fell on the couch where Queen Esther was reclining, just as the king was returning from the palace garden. So the king walks back into this scene, which was kind of like a, hey, get off my wife kind of moment. And he says, will Haman even molest the queen while she's with me in my own house? It's not looking good for Haman. One of the attendants standing nearby sees the king's rage. And he comes up with a suggestion. He says, excuse me, king, but were you aware that a gallows 75 feet high stands by Haman's house? He had it made for Mordecai, the one who spoke up to help the king. And the king said, hang him on it. And so they hanged Haman on the gallows he had prepared for Mordecai. You can't make stuff up this good. Unreal. All right, it's getting late. You got one more? You got one more? Okay, final episode. Episode 8, Undercover Boss. On that same day, the king gives Esther all of Haman's estate. And Esther places Mordecai over it all. And because the king had already signed the edict against the Jews, he couldn't revoke it. So he has Mordecai issue a new decree that was again translated and sent out to all the provinces. And the headline read this, on March 7th, Jews in every city have the right to assemble and protect themselves, to destroy and kill any armed force, nationality, or province that might attack them. Verse 1 of chapter 9. So on March 7th, the two decrees the king were put into effect. On that day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, but quite the opposite happened. It was the Jews who overpowered their enemies. Now I'm calling episode 8, Undercover Boss, because while both Mordecai and Esther displayed some unbelievable courage and leadership, the hero of the story, the architect of this whole thing, totally behind the scenes. One of the most intriguing things about the book of Esther is that God's name is never mentioned in it. But don't confuse God's name not being in it with God not being in it, because he is all over this story. I mean, just like with every great drama, behind the scenes, there's a writer, there's a director, there's a producer who knows every scene, is involved in every line, sees every angle, is in complete control of the whole epic story. I mean, Spielberg, Scorsese, Spike Lee, J.J. Abrams, Ron Howard, they got nothing on God. I mean, could it just so happen that Vashti is banished at the very time when Esther is at the right age to be picked for tryouts? I mean, could it just so happen that out of thousands of beautiful women coming to the king for 4 years, Esther, the orphan Jewish girl, is the one that's chosen? Could it just so happen that the Jewish nation would face annihilation at the exact same time the queen happens to be Jewish? Could it just so happen that although it was against the law and the king didn't have a reputation for tolerating disrespectful wives, that Esther wins his favor? Could it just so happen that while a plot is being carried out to kill Mordecai, the king has a sleepless night and his bedtime story is about the day Mordecai saved his life? Could it just so happen that the gallows built for Haman were already built by his own ego? Could it just so happen that all of this would take time at a place where the Jewish community was scattered and displaced, that they would come together and become strong again? No way. That is totally God. He is the hero of the story, working behind the scenes and everything. He does that, you know? I mean, maybe you've been through seasons of your life where you couldn't figure out how God was working, where God was, what he was doing. But you look back now, and you go, oh my goodness, that just couldn't have just happened. God was in it the whole time. His hand was all over. Or maybe you're going through something right now, and for the life of you, you cannot figure out where God is in the story. You can't seem to find his involvement. His name is not on the page. I think he gave us the story of Esther so that we would know, even when we can't see him, he's there. He's working in the dark, right where you are right now. So don't be afraid. Be brave. Take a step of faith. because you are not alone. When fear rips you and insecurity grips you, know that He equips you to walk through that door. When shame makes you pause to keep you from the cause, when no one stands with you, know that He does. When the past screams, "Who are you to do such a thing?" know that there's one who's working behind the scenes to give you the courage, the power, the words, the resolve to stand in His love against all odds, to remind you of who you are, that you are now His, and that you have been made for such a time as this. Let's bow our heads for a moment. You know, if you and I are going to live courageous lives, we have to know that we don't have to be the hero of the story. We just need to take a courageous step of faith and let Him do His work. And I don't know what God's asking you to do these days or what step of courage or step of faith you need to take. But I'm telling you step out, you will not regret it, because He will be right there with you. He's working behind the scenes. One of the most incredible things about this story is the great lengths God went to keep the nation of Israel alive and vibrant so that Jesus Christ could be born, so that the Messiah, the Savior, the one who would redeem us from our sin, could come into this world as God promised He would and give us eternal life. Father, every time I read this story, it blows me away. Thanks for putting it in Your word. Thanks that even though Your name's not on the page, there's no mistaking that you're all over it. It is such a good reminder to us today that even when we can't see Your hand, we can still trust Your heart and know that You are the inexhaustible God who's working 24/7 in our lives, totally in the dark, behind the scenes. Thank You for doing that. Thank You for the way You shape our character. Thank You for the way You walk with us through scary opportunities. God, I pray right now for anybody that's just facing a lot of fear and anxiety about a step of faith they need to take. I pray that today would be that pivotal day. They said, I showed up at a church or I joined online and I went, oh my goodness. God's telling me to grab some courage that I was born for such a time as this. I pray that today might mark that in someone's life. Thank You so much for the way You teach us and lead us. And I pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen. And you know what? When Esther sent that message back to Mordecai and said, Would you have the Jewish people just fast and pray for me for the next 3 days to give me the courage to do this? And maybe you need some prayer for a decision that you're facing, or maybe you're scared about something, anything going on in your life. We're going to have some great folks down front, and as we're singing a worship song, while we're singing, just come on down front and have somebody pray with you. Let's stand up together and worship, and we'll do that in the next few moments.